First we have an outbreak of superpowers. And now we have a soi-disant mad scientist with really bad typographic taste on her hands. How could things possibly get any worse? Chapter 5. The Office. The next day I awaken early, with a mild hangover, and a bad case of, oh dear God, did I really say that to the senior auditor? I roll over and reach out, meaning to ask Bob's opinion, and hit cold air on the other side of an unfamiliar hotel bed. Everything crashes down on me at once, and I sit bolt upright. Then reflex takes over. I reach for my laptop. I have email. Lots of email. Temporary office space has been assigned in one of our outlying buildings just south of the river, under the shadow of the glittering green glass block pile that is Legoland, the Secret Intelligence Service Headquarters building. That's MI6 to you. A memo from Emma McDougall. She's going to spend the morning trawling for available staff to assign to my department, and she'll send them across as soon as possible. Damn. I'll have to get into the new office early to head them off at the pass. Another email. This time from the Secure Metropolitan Police intranet. Joe Sullivan wants to talk to me. Well, that's good to know, because I want to talk to her. The shortest route to an arrested villain in an interview room is through his arresting officer's boss. And Stripjack Sprat is currently the only lead I've got on this Freudstein character. Of course, I'm not totally naive, so I Google Freudstein before I even think about going downstairs and seeing if my room tariff includes breakfast. First hit, an EBM techno band from Brighton. Second hit, the villain in an obscure Italian cult horror movie from 1981. Somehow neither of these seem like promising candidates for the sort of lunatic who'd break into the Bank of England. I rub my forehead and groan. Usually when I go to sleep, all the crises of the day look better, or at least more distant, the next morning. This is that rare and unwelcome exception. A day when I wake up to find that yesterday's bad news is still rumbling downhill, gathering momentum like a giant snowball. Despair, dismay, disorientation, and delusion. The four horsemen of the bureaucratic apocalypse are coming my way. I want to crawl back under the covers and hide from the world, but somehow, I don't think the world is going to let me escape so easily. So I roll sideways out of bed, a day older and a day creakier, and shuffle towards the compact hotel bathroom. Someone has been kind enough to send my suitcase over. I raid it for a change of underwear, then dress in my work weeds and head downstairs. I discover that I am set up for breakfast. Unfortunately, the hotel buffet is pretty much wall-to-wall fried meat and carbs. I manage to choke down a bowl of muesli and some diabolically bad coffee before giving up and retreating back to my room. A quick call to the front desk confirms that I've got the room for two more nights thanks to the SA. Bless his little cotton socks for thinking it through. By Friday the tabloids will begin to lose interest, and by Saturday I might be able to sneak back into my own home through the kitchen window without being mugged by paparazzi. So I collect my violin case, shoehorn my laptop into my handbag, and head for the nearest tube station. It's time to go to work. Work turns out to be a rented office suite in a refurbished warehouse in Hoxton, an odd survivor left over from the Silicon Roundabout boom. The local council helpfully kicked out all the startups to make room for student flats. Apparently rented accommodation is better for the post-housing boom economy than creating new businesses. I get there a whisker before 10 o'clock. There's an anonymous-looking steel door with an entry phone system and reinforced bolts. Behind it, there's a security desk, two unlabeled doorways with complex locks on them, and a blue suitor who failed to hop on the G4S gravy train when it rolled past. Dr. O'Brien. I introduce myself, showing my warrant card. I gather I have an office here? The security officer stirs himself for long enough to look at my card, then does a double take.
I'm sorry, Mom. Director, let me sign you in.
He takes my card and scans it, then unlocks a drawer and hands the card back to me, along with a lanyard and badge. I freeze for a moment, eyeball to eyeball with a glassy-eyed version of me who looks as if she's just swallowed a frog.
Please, come this way.
We go through the left door, which unlocks when you hold your ID badge against the sensor and face a camera at eye level. Behind it, the guard ushers me along a narrow windowless corridor, up the elevator to the fourth floor, and out into a stairwell with a glass-fronted interior reception area beyond it.
All yours, Mom. I'd better get back to the front desk.
All mine? It feels very strange. There's a bog-standard bleached pine desk in the lobby area, but no PC or chair yet. A pile of flat-pack furniture boxes stacked up behind it appear to have been abandoned by the previous occupants. There are the usual false floor and ceiling tiles, beige carpet for the one, and off-white polystyrene for the other. I use my badge to let myself into the offices beyond, noting that the door might be made of glass, but it's more than 2 centimeters thick, and the copper and wire mesh gasket of a Faraday cage is visible in the doorframe, a security precaution intended to block wireless emissions. A completely empty office suite is more than a little eerie. I walk a circuit of the rectangular corridor, noting office doors, toilets, cafeteria. The cafeteria is bare, cupboard doors hanging open like hungry mouths. The only office with any distinguishing features at all is at the far corner. There's a discreet plaque on the door that says, Director. I go in. As director, I apparently rate a spacious, airy corner office with thick pile carpet and tinted windows that overlook the high street. More than that, before I get to it, I have to run the gauntlet of a medium-sized outer office that is clearly intended for the director's personal assistant. My offices are bigger than the top floor of my house. Alas, the effect is slightly spoiled by the profound lack of any visible furniture. Raised floor panels show where the phones and network cables will be plumbed in. But I suppose they think I'm such an elevated personage that I can just levitate in lotus position until such time as someone delivers my desk and chair. I pull out my phone to call facilities back at the new annex, but just as I'm about to dial, it vibrates to announce an incoming call. So much for the Faraday cage. There's a familiar face on the screen, and for a heart-stabbing moment, I consider not answering. But no, that's not an option. Bob?
Mo, how are you? I heard about the news.
Where are you? Where are you staying? I haven't been back home since yesterday lunchtime. Our words collide and overlap in a birefringent sheen of ripples. Or perhaps that's just my eyes. I stop and listen, clinging to the phone as if it's a lifesaver.
I'm in the new annex, Mo. It's a real mess here. The fire extinguishers were triggered. There's water damage and other stuff. Second floor's utterly inaccessible, while the crime scene folks work it over. I'm crashing on my office floor. I've got a sleeping bag. They want me to disarm all the traps in Angleton's office and get into the mimics. It could take some time. How about you?
I twirl in place, very slowly. Is he sleeping in the office to avoid me, or avoid Lecter? That's the question. They've given me a corner office. Great view, shame about the furniture. Emma said she'd start sending people over this afternoon, but unless facilities get here first, I've got nowhere to put them. I realise dismally that we're talking about work. Retreating into the routine to avoid dealing with the uncanny rift that's opened up between us. I need moral support. Can we meet up somewhere?
Yes, but You said you haven't been home.
Paparazzi, dear.
Did you feed Spooky?
Oh, snap. I knew I'd forgotten something. Horrid little flea bag. Yes, but that was yesterday, and you were going to clean the litter tray and I can't go home. I'm horribly busy and the journalists will doorstep me.
Just stop it, Mo.
He sounds weary.
I'll go round there as soon as I can get away from here, find a cattery or something. Park her in my office if not. It's not fair to leave her alone in an empty house.
I take a deep breath. I can go home on Saturday. The SA reckons the tabloids will lose interest after 72 hours. I realize how stupid this is the moment I see it. I'm going to give a bored cat the free run of the house and bedroom and ample time to demonstrate its diabolically inventive, not to say fragrant, displeasure. I may not like cats, but that's only because I understand the way their twisty little minds work. If you can find time to pick her up sometime today, I'd be ever so... I dangle a concession in front of him. You can even bring her home to stay once I'm able to move back in.
Okay, I'll do that. We still need to talk.
My phone vibrates again. Uh-oh, I've got an incoming. Looks like it's Emma. Can we continue this later? Great. Bye. Smooches, I add. But he's already hung up. So by the time I utter the last word, I'm speaking to Mrs. McDougall from Human Resources. Oops, that was meant for my husband. How are you this morning, Emma?
I'm fine.
There's a rather odd emphasis in her voice, as if to imply, but you aren't. But maybe that's just my paranoia speaking.
I was calling to give you your initial personnel assignments, as you probably gathered things are a little hectic today. But I've found 4 warm bodies for your team, and we can fill in from there as the week goes on. I've got names for group tech support, 2 analyst planners, and of course your deputy director.
That's great, I say, and I mean it. But where am I going to put them? There's no furniture here, Emma. Not even chairs. Has anyone told facilities?
Oh, hell. Moira was supposed to get onto that first thing. I told her to send 6 employee kits over.
Would they be flat packs by any chance? I stalk towards the lobby area.
Yes. 6 desks, 6 chairs, 6 individual bookcases, and a supply cupboard.
Bingo. The teetering pile of boxes stares at me. Could you maybe send someone round with a screwdriver? No. Make that a full toolbox, and 6 six-way mains extension bars. My notebook is weighing my handbag down. I don't think we've got any network access here, so I'll email you a bullet list of everything else I can think of that we're going to need in the next 24 hours. We're going to be running on laptops and external security discipline for a while.
You do that,
Emma says warmly.
Anything else I can do for you?
Yes. Just tell anyone who asks that we're not open for business today. Tomorrow is another matter.
Okay, bye.
Bye. I put my phone away and head back to my enormous empty office. I park Lecter's case in the corner between the 2 windows, sit cross-legged in the middle of the carpet, and start typing furiously on my laptop. Because tomorrow may belong to me. But the day after tomorrow belongs to the Home Secretary. And if I'm not ready to deliver a dog and pony show by Monday, the presence or absence of our departmental coffee percolator will be the least of my worries. The day passes in a blur. If you've ever moved house, you'll have some inkling of what it's like to bootstrap an empty office suite from scratch. I spend the first hour writing want lists for Emma to throw at her minions. Then the front door buzzer beeps for attention. It's a bloke from facilities, with toolbox, as requested. 1 employee desk and chair set needs to go in each of those offices, I point, starting with the director's corner office and the receptionist's room. If there's a separate management grade kit, give it to the director. And the stores cupboard can go in there. I wave vaguely at the empty windowless room next to the kitchen.
Sure, and I can be doing that.
He grins cheerily.
I'll have you somewhere to sit in a jiffy.
You get started, I nod. I'm nipping out, back in an hour. It turns out that there's a Cafe Nero around the corner with free Wi-Fi and comfy leather sofas. They're playing tag with Starbucks for the migratory worker base. So I take self plus violin there and plant myself behind a laptop screen and a venti mocha with a double shot and a good view of the door and windows. Then I start hammering the keys. It turns out the HR have a canned departmental starter kit on file, and there are a lot of forms to fill out. Yes, we've all had the security talk about open wireless networks. I've also had the weekly special incluing from my dear husband. We have a VPN and firewalls, and you do not want to mess with them because the design spec for the laundry's firewall software is not to keep intruders out, but to make them undergo spontaneous combustion when they get in. As Bob puts it, it's the only way to be sure. After an hour in the cafe, I drift furtively back to my office suite. There is now a sign on the glass lobby door. Transhuman Policy Coordination Unit. It strikes me as indiscreet at first, but then I think it through. Given that I'm running a Potemkin village, indiscretion had better be my middle name from now on. Just as long as it's planned, indiscretion. Back in my office, things are looking up. It contains a desk and a chair, both so grand that they really demand capitalization. The desk is a very fine desk indeed. My laptop sits adrift in the middle of its empty bleached wood grain ocean, looking lost. The director's throne is a high-end piece of Herman Miller sculpture, all resin and chrome. It looks as if it was designed by H.R. Geiger. I check it carefully for teeth and ovipositors before I dare to sit on it. Once adjusted to my height and seating position, it is indeed indecently comfortable. I feel as if I'm levitating. Then I look at my laptop's battery status and swear. Martin from facilities sticks his head around the door while I'm crawling around on my hands and knees, plugging the computer's power supply into the socket under the desk.
Miss, there's someone at the front desk who says he's been sent over to see you.
I scoot backwards and sit up, barely managing not to bang my head on the underside of the desk.
Send him in.
So much for directorial dignity. Bob did this for a living for years on end, crawling under desks with one end of a cable clutched between his teeth. No wonder he went mad and volunteered for active ops. I'm back on my throne by the time the door opens.
Hello?
A hipsterish head, mid-twenties male, owlish black horn-rimmed spectacles and highly ironic beard oozes round the doorframe, followed shortly thereafter by a hipsterish body.
Dr. O'Brien? I'm Samuel Jennings. Emma McDougall sent me.
She did she? I look at him for a while, until he swallows. There's probably a personnel file clogging up my inbox, but I like to get an unvarnished look at people before I resort to the funhouse mirror of HR's misconceptions. The next personnel file I read that describes its subject accurately will be the first. At best, they're misleadingly out of date, and at worst, they're just plain misleading. As you can see, things are a bit sparse around here right now. Sorry, there's no visitor's chair yet. Your file hasn't caught up with you, so... Samuel, or is it Sam? What do you do?
What?
He shifts gears with an almost audible clunk.
Oh, that. Senior analyst, level 2.
Background in abstract theoretical xenobiology with application to endogenous evolved neurocomputing architecture. The beard twitches in a self-deprecatingly ironic smile.
I think I'm here because I got caught moonlighting a year ago and HR carpeted me for it.
Moonlighting? I do a double take. Is that even possible? This is the laundry. We have an oath of office that fries us from the inside out if we do anything remotely dodgy. I lean forward.
What were you doing?
I have a hobby. script-writing comics. I'm a so-so illustrator, but after doing some indie work, I landed a gig writing for a second-tier Titan property.
Right. So, and this qualifies you to work for Transhuman Policy Coordination...
How?
Beats me. But HR seemed to think that writing about intelligent alien insect invaders from Sirius qualifies me as an expert on the paranormally enhanced.
He shrugs. My office got trashed the day before yesterday, so I'm temporarily homeless, and there's the Xenotech neurocomputing specialty to consider, and I'm an analyst, so I got this call from Moira in HR, and she said, "You're the superhero expert. Go analyze." So, here I am.
Cool. You'll have to tell me all about the comics business someday.
I stand up.
Let's go find you an office.
Got laptop?
Got laptop.
He pats a carnivorous-looking crumpler messenger bag.
Let's get you going, then.
Huh. As you can see, we've barely begun moving in. You can start by drawing up a wish list for equipment, and I'll forward it to facilities. Anything you expect, you'll need to get an analysis and reporting office for four up and running within the next month. You can also answer the door and send anybody new who shows up through to me. That's just for today, mind. Tomorrow we'll hold an all-hands at 2 o'clock sharp. Clear?
Absolutely.
His head bobs. He looks at me with an expression that makes me feel very strange for a few seconds. Until I realize what it signifies. I've mostly seen it in research students up till now. It's the look you give your new and terrifyingly efficient and impressive boss on your way out their office door for the first time you meet them when you realise that you've survived the encounter and you don't even need a change of underwear.
Am I that kind of office dragon?
It'll be fun finding out. By 6 o'clock, I'm about ready to call it a wrap for the day. It's threatening to get dark outside. The shadows are lengthening in the canyon-like street below my window, and the traffic is hitting its rush hour peak. In addition to Sam, I have acquired another analyst. Nick, mid-30s, serious male pattern baldness on top, wiry build that hints at alarmingly athletic exercise preferences, specialises in traffic analysis, owns a huge DVD collection, and identifies himself as a sad fan who goes to conventions for fun. Almost as if it's an ethnicity or a calling. And a techie. Sarah. I vaguely know her. She used to work for Bob a couple of years ago. Sarah gets a phone installed on every desk by 5 o'clock, promises to plumb us into the intranet tomorrow morning, and even finds me a visitor's chair from somewhere. She seems a bit shy and diffident. But then again, I'm 15 years her senior, and the sign on my door says, "Director." So, Sam, Nick, and Sarah have gone home, and at 6:30, I'm all alone in the office, finishing up my PowerPoint slides for tomorrow's all hands, when there's a knock on the door.
"Come in,"
I say, not looking up.
"Hi, I'm your new deputy director." "Oh, shit."
I look up and freeze.
"You,"
we both say at the same time. The door swings shut behind my new deputy director with a solid click. I stare at her, calculating angles and distances. It doesn't look good. Lecter is about 3 meters behind my chair, leaning against the corner between the windows. I don't have a gun or a knife. Facilities haven't installed the security wards in this room yet, and there's no panic button. Even if I had a hotline to the blue suitors on the front desk, I very much doubt they could get here in time to help.
"What's that on your face?" "Theatrical makeup."
Her glare could curdle milk.
"Nobody mentioned I'd be working for you. What a fucking mess."
"Take a seat." I see, heart pounding and the small of my back suddenly prickling hot and slick with sweat.
"No thanks. I'd rather stand."
Mary stares at me. I stare back at her. She's a willowy blonde, with a figure fit to send vapid 20-something non-supermodels into paroxysms of jealousy. Her only flaw is that her face is pancaked with theatrical quantities of makeup. She does the severe office power suit thing way better than I do. Everything's black, except for her high-collared red silk blouse. She looks like the walking human incarnation of a venomous spider. It takes me an extra moment to notice that she's wearing opaque black hosiery and gloves. The only skin on display is her face.
Nice outfit. Sun getting to you?
It's a workaround. She reaches into her handbag and produces a pair of mirrored aviator shades. A suboptimal one. She twirls them lazily between left index finger and thumb, like an Old West gunslinger. I need to get control of this situation, fast. I'll give you a choice. You can go out the door, go back to whatever box they put you in, and I'll tell Emma to roll the dice again, without prejudice. Or you can sit down, I point at the chair, right now, and we will work this out. My heart is going about 150 beats a minute, and I'm so keyed up that my hand is shaking. I lower it hastily, in case she notices. Cold sweat terror claws at the back of my neck.
Promise you won't try to kill me with that thing.
I note her gaze tracking towards the corner between the windows. My perspective flips, in another of those dizzying Reuben Vaz moments. Is she afraid of me? Don't be silly. Killing one's staff is workplace harassment. Definitely gross misconduct. I think it's a sacking offence. It's also murder, and the Black Assizes take a very dim view of it. But I don't bring that up. I don't want her to feel too comfortable. I pause. Sit down, and let's talk things over like grown-ups. She sits, but she's wound up like a watch spring. Back straight, knees together, oversized black leather handbag clenched on her lap.
Is this some kind of sick joke?
I consider the idea.
Very possibly.
But if so, who is the joke aimed at? And where's the joker?
Emma told me this is a new departmental start-up, a public front to deflect attention from the laundry. Also an attempt to contain the pervert soup problem.
Very succinct.
Yes. You're directing it, why? Is this something to do with yesterday's headlines?
Kid, you have no idea. I nod stiffly. I've been reallocated. My old job became non-viable the instant the TV cameras locked on.
Oh.
I recognize that expression from somewhere. I wish I didn't. I don't need her sympathy, however grudging.
Right.
I lace my fingers together in front of me to stop my hands from shaking with the effort of not fidgeting as I stare back at her. Why do you think Emma thought you were suited for the role of deputy director of this unit? I see her hesitate, so I add. If it helps, try to imagine you're talking to someone else. Animal, vegetable, sentient cauliflower from Arcturus, it doesn't matter, just as long as they're not me. I don't need egg-sucking lessons. Her lip curls, momentarily supercilious. Then she realizes what she's doing, and hides it behind an instantly raised hand. Anything to avoid slipping me a flash of the old ivory gnashers.
Really, it's not hard. I spent 3 years in HR, back in the day. Then I transferred to the deactivation list and was outplaced into the second largest investment bank in Europe. While I was working there, I did a part-time MBA and worked in a variety of roles, most recently as the operations manager for an internal business unit with a turnover of roughly £200 million a year.
She squares her shoulders and sticks her chest out.
I am also a blood-sucking fiend, out and proud. Superpowers? I have them. What do you bring to the table, Mrs. Howard?
I grin and bare my teeth at her.
That's Dr. O'Brien to you, Miss Murphy.
I glance over my shoulder at Lecter. His case is the right way round to display the sticker on its side. This machine kills demons. That facetious bumper sticker sums up what I used to do for our organisation. Our real organisation, that is. I destroy emergent threats. When I'm not doing field work, I have a PhD in philosophy of mathematics, lecture part-time in music theory at Birkbeck, and specialise in the application of fast Fourier transforms to psychoacoustic summoning systems. And I appear to be your designated line manager. Superpowers, I do not have. But I've got 5 years on this highly annoying person, and age and guile trump youth and enthusiasm. Or so they say. I must remember to bear in mind that I've only got 5 years on her. She may be able to pass for her early 20s, but she's roughly Bob's age. Unfortunately, in addition to the butterflies that come of knowing I'm unarmed and in the presence of a potentially immortal and super strong obligate carnivore, I've got a curious sinking sensation in my stomach. It comes from the realization that, on paper at least, Mary is impressively well qualified to be my executive officer. Right, she says crisply. So, the job of this unit is to generate and then execute a strategy for containing and mitigating the superhero nuisance. We've got office space, 2 analysts, and a target? She raises a latex-smeared eyebrow, and I nod very slightly. And all that's holding us back is a marked lack of trust between the designated director and their executive assistant. I nod again. She leans forward as she speaks, loudly and clearly. I did not fuck your husband. I nod once more, feeling cornered despite all the empty space behind my chair. Mezzo forte. I didn't even drink his blood. The only way to respond is fortissimo. So that makes everything all right? I swear at myself. She's clearly trying to build bridges. Why am I trying to knock them down? She rises to a crescendo. Can we agree that he should probably have let you know I was staying over? If pauses can be pregnant, this one's on the run from a fertility clinic. A drop of sweat trickles down the small of my back. Reevaluate, reevaluate, prioritise. On Monday morning, I have to stand up in front of the Home Secretary and deliver a cogent, achievable plan for getting Her Majesty's government out in front of the paranormal power-assisted pervert suit menace, Stat. This woman, who I dislike intensely, who seriously fucked up Bob before I met him, and spent a couple of years working through his neuroses about the opposite sex. This woman who I trust as far as I can throw her. This vampire bitch from Human Resources who nearly triggers panic attacks when I see her also happens to be exactly the strong right arm that I need to get the job done. And besides, she's got a point. Even if it falls perilously close to blaming the one person who isn't present at the meeting. Yes. Fine. She switches on a smile so manic that I'm certain the last pixie dream girl she mugged is in need of a face transplant. Does that mean you agree that the potential exists for us to construct and maintain an arm's-length business relationship based on team values, mutual esteem, and peer-to-peer respect for our complementary abilities? One that's free from any incursion of bedroom politics and green-eyed jealousy. Oh, for fuck's sake. If I could mend fences with Ramona, I ought at least try to get along with Mary without sucking her soul out through her eyeballs with my violin. As long as she keeps her fangs out of my neck and Bob out of her bed, I can probably do this. Jealousy is such a nasty word, I say. Then I narrow my eyes. But I have a question for you. Why are you so keen to work with me? Mary rolls her eyes. Because in business terms, you just parachuted straight into the CEO seat of an entrepreneurial startup that bypassed the incubator and angel rounds and went straight to a juicy Series A term sheet. Some of the tension has leached out of her shoulders. The handbag sits limp on her lap. Her knees aren't clenched as tightly. She no longer looks... Good Lord, she was terrified. You probably think I'm an ambitious, greasy pole climber. If so, you'd be absolutely right. You might just have noticed that I have special dietary needs. Expensive ones.
The laundry will find a way to feed me, no questions asked, as long as I make myself useful. You might be a workaholic who lives for the job, but if I don't work, I don't get to live. Not dying is a wonderful motivating factor, don't you think? So I need to make myself indispensable, or at least too useful to put down.
She relaxes infinitesimally as she gets into her pitch, but her expression remains intense. I have the uneasy sense that I'm getting a window on the real Mary's soul, one that she doesn't draw back the curtains on very often.
In business, the fastest way to the top is to join a new organization in the early days and make it grow under you. If you join an established company, you have to fight your way up through all the accumulated deadwood. Unfortunately, new banking startups don't come along very often. The Scrum was going to be my ticket to the boardroom, but then Fang happened. So, anyway, speaking as an ambitious management bitch, my plan is simple. Get on board a new org chart early, push for growth, Series B, Series C. There is no IPO when you're part of a government agency. The usual breakout in the age of privatization is to be spun off as a GovCo, then sold to one of the big service corporations. But there is a plateau of stability when the growth curve stabilizes, at which point the executives can run out the gangway and waltz back over to rejoin their parent organizations at a much higher level than they were at when they left a comparatively short time ago. Take you, for example. If this works, your new department won't last forever. But if you go back to the laundry, you'll take your new grade with you.
Wow. If this was a marketing presentation, it would be standing ovation time. Her intensity is terrifying. It makes me want to pin a notice on her power suit saying, "Front towards enemy." An idea for how to harness her dangerous energy begins to percolate up from the depths of my subconscious. I keep a lid on it for now. The interview isn't over yet. But it bears exploration just as soon as I've cleared up some loose ends.
Okay, I hear where you're coming from. I have a couple of follow-on questions, though. Does your condition mean you'll have difficulty keeping regular office hours or appearing in public? And what are you doing about, eating in the short term?
My condition is my problem, she says tartly. You might want to bear in mind the civil service policy guidelines on respect for disabilities in the workplace before you ask such questions. But since you ask, in the absolute worst case, a full traditional hijab and niqab will keep me from frying. And in overcast and twilight conditions, I can get away with theatrical face paint and sunglasses. So yes, I can be on hand during core office hours, although I'll need to have blackout blinds fitted in my office. Point due. I still mostly eat normal food. The question of how to provide a regular supply of my special dietary supplement is being dealt with by a committee chaired by Dr. Wills. For an instant, I see a flicker of something that might almost be grief cross her face. But the pancake of latex and foundation she's wearing makes it hard to read micro-expressions. Again, may I remind you of our policy on disabilities? Other people have equally distasteful needs. It's only relatively recently that individuals with growth hormone deficiency gained a source of somatotropin that wasn't harvested from cadaver brains, for example.
I restart.
You've made your point.
I stand up slowly and wearily make my way around my desk. And she stands up, her posture defensive. Fight or flee. I suppress a panic shudder and stop a meter away from her, just outside her personal space. Then I force myself to raise my right hand.
Welcome aboard, I say.
After a second, she raises her hand too. We shake, very gingerly. Her nylon-sheathed fingers are slippery and cool.
No backstabbing, she says.
Maybe it's an offer. No annoying personal shit, I counter-offer. Let's keep it 100% professional. She nods, unsmiling. All right. Now what? I exhale slowly, still shuddery shaky from my initial reaction to her. Tomorrow at 2 o'clock I'm holding an all-hands. I'm supposed to deliver a briefing with concrete proposals to the Home Secretary on Monday morning. Everything is secondary to that. We're going to be working in crunch mode until then. We've got a looming first deadline, and if we don't make it, we are dead in the water. So dead, there won't be a hole deep enough to bury us in. So, it's going to be 16-hour days and working all weekend if necessary. Unfortunately, I've also got some off-site stuff to do. Stuff that is so time-critical it can't wait because it may feed into the home sex briefing. So, I need you to keep an eye on the analysts and manage the new intake of staff while I'm out of the office. She bites her lower lip, still keeping her canines discreetly out of sight. Do you have a strategy? I do indeed. I reach over to the desk and spin the notebook round so that we can both see the screen. Let me talk you through it. Chapter 6. An Excitable Boy. I stumble through my hotel room's doorway just after 11 o'clock, bone-tired and shaky from the post-adrenaline crash. I'm still only half certain there's a chance that my paper plane will leave the runway. Mary and I put in nearly 4 hours on the key strategy proposal and my presentation, and she kicked the tires very thoroughly before she handed me the metaphorical air hose. If she can be trusted to hold up her end of the deal, we might be able to make it fly. If. Ah well. I may not trust her personally. Actually, I can barely hold back my fight-flight impulse in her presence, but I can't fault her motivation. If I can learn not to break out in a hot flush, or get the shudders, or random stabs of ossified reflexive jealousy when she walks in the door, and if she can learn not to jump out of her skin when I pick up my violin case, as she did when we were leaving, and then she tried to make a shaky voice joke of it. We can make policy faster than a speeding bullet and leap tall buildings full of paperwork. But it's going to take practice. And a lot of patience. Once I crawl between the sheets, I go out like a lamp. Sleep is dreamless at first. But sometime in the small hours I awaken just enough to do the bathroom sleepwalk shuffle. And when I go back to bed, I start to dream. I'm on that monochrome dance floor again, whirling in the arms of my white-clad faceless lover. This time, it's no waltz. I'm gothed up like my mid-teenaged self's vision of her aspirational adult persona. All rather jejune, with way too much black lace. What can I say? It was a phase I was going through, as we danced to a new romantic 80s synth-pop beat. There's a band between the columns of speakers, faceless men in suits surrounded by a wall of ancient Korg and Yamaha kit. The Damned Don't Cry. Enola Gay. As we whirl to the dance floor beat, I feel like a machine, as soulless as my partner, who leans towards my face and whispers, "You could have taken her soul." You say that like you think I should want it. His voice is autumn leaves blowing through the doorway of an open crypt. Mine is toneless. He pulls me closer. "You should have taken her. She lied to you." I can't kill people just because they lie to me, or because I don't like them. He laughs and whirls me in a tight circle. I lean backwards, relying on his arms around me for support. "You've killed people you didn't like before. Firouz, the Prisdaran lieutenant in Vakilabad. The nest of idiot goat worshippers in Amstelveen. You're..." "Shut up and dance." It's not a very goth dance. It's far too intimate. I break out of his grip, sway sidelong away, then catch the rhythm. Grab the bat. Hug the bat, drop the bat, work those hips, raise your arms, Big box, little box, big box, little box. Back to swaying on the spot. Grab the bat. Hug the bat. Drop the bat. Kick the bat across the dance floor. Then I grab the bat again and suddenly find my arms filled by my dance partner. His arms wrapped around me like the steel bars of an impossible cage.
Love is all you need.
He whispers breathily in my ear and runs his tongue down the side of my neck to the base of my throat. The rasp of his flinty tongue strikes a spark that sets me on fire. I wrap my arms around him and play intimate chords of power on the fingerboard of his spine. He shivers eerily and lifts me, and I wrap my knees around his hips then. The logic of dreams hold no brief for zippers, underwear, or hook-and-eye fasteners. His teeth are locked around my painfully taut right nipple as he lowers me onto his sound post. I become one with the sound as we whirl around the dance floor in a frenzy of pleasure, pulses rippling through me as we fade to grey. I come to my senses in a pile of cold, sweat-drenched sheets, shuddering in the receding wake of the most powerful orgasm I've had since... No, stop. That's far too long ago. I try to roll over. No, too soon. According to the alarm radio, it's 6:45. Not fair. I reach for the light switch and glare bleary-eyed at the violin case on the hotel room desk. Why does it seem to look smug? Bastard, I mutter as I try to sit up. I feel obscurely guilty. It was just an erotic dream. I don't cheat on my husband. At least I don't think I do. Do imaginary violins count? To my sleep-clouded eyes, Lecter's case seems slightly flaccid, slowly pulsing. Or maybe it's just the arteries in the back of my eyeballs. I take a long shower, mainly because I crave the sensation of washing ghostly, adulterous fingertips off my skin. I have to lean against the wall. My knees are so weak. It was positively tectonic. I close my eyes under the warm rain and wish Bob was here to hold me in the afterglow. I dress in my second best work suit, the houndstooth check Jaeger one. It's a bit frumpy, if I'm perfectly honest with myself. Maybe too frumpy, but even though my work wardrobe needs an overhaul in light of my new job, I am damned if I'm going to get into a sartorial arms race with Mary. Before she became a fang, she was merely pretty. Now she could take up modelling if it wasn't for the slight bursting into flames when exposed to bright lights problem. I go with the lowest heels and the least office makeup I can get away with. I've got a lot of walking to do today. I don't bother with the vile hotel breakfast. Instead, I collect Lecter, and I'm out the door by 8:30, straight into the comfortingly anonymous rush hour crowd, and on my way to the first appointment of the day. Nobody sane drives in London. I take the bus. By the time I get to my destination, I've lost most of my early mover time, but I've had a chance to come fully awake, meditate for a few minutes, and go over my agenda 3 or 4 times in search of holes. I can't spot any. I fend off flashbacks as I walk back along a stretch of pavement that rings under my heels with echoes of the other day's walk to the scaffold experience. I'm reasonably centred again, back in my professional sweet spot, and more importantly, I know what to expect today. So I'm feeling reasonably confident when I march up to the front desk of Belgravia Police Station and say, "Dominique O'Brien to see Chief Inspector Sullivan. I have an appointment." For a moment, I'm afraid the desk sergeant is going to succumb to my middle-aged invisibility field. But then his roving eyeballs land on my warrant card and his pupils dilate slightly as it snags the surface of his mind.
Yes, ma'am.
He doesn't exactly snap to attention. His attitude is more like one of suppressed annoyance at having his routine interrupted by the urgent need to perform hand-holding duties for a senior officer who ought to know better. But, suddenly, he's all over the switchboard.
DCI Sullivan, please.
A Dr. O'Brien is waiting for you.
Where?
I'll send her over right away, Mom.
He looks back at me.
She's in the custody suite, Mom. The special one. Is that where you're expecting to find her?
I nod.
Which way is it?
He grabs a constable who is hurrying past.
Julie, would you be a dear and show the superintendent here to the special custody suite? DCI Sullivan is waiting on her.
Julie, suffering the be a dear in professional silence, leads me through the badger set that is the backside of the police station. Scuffed white paint, flickering overhead tubes, and a pervasive smell of stale coffee. And then down a concrete stairwell to a heavy steel door overlooked by half a dozen cameras in armoured enclosures.
This is the old custody suite, Mom. The main one's on the other side of the building. We were using this to store the riot kit until they repurposed it for the differently empowered 3 months ago. Have they filled you in on that? The special handling requirements.
I'm here to see Jo Sullivan about it, I reassure her. She'll fill me in.
Great. May I go? I was on my way to a briefing when... Go on.
Pause.
And thanks.
I call after her, rapidly receding back. Then I turn to the heavy steel door, the like of which one normally only finds in bank vaults and other places that store stuff that really shouldn't be allowed to escape. There is a very prosaic white plastic doorbell stapled inexpertly to the wall next to it. I push the button. A minute later, there is a squeal of inadequately lubricated gears as the door slides open a crack.
Dominique, good to see you again.
I cross the threshold and shake hands with Joe. The threshold is about 10 centimetres thick and cross-hatched with yellow stripes and warning stickers showing the grisly things that will happen to you if you happen to be standing in the doorway when the power door closes.
So, this is the superhero lockup.
Yeah, one of them.
Joe takes a step backwards and gestures me in. As I follow her, the huge vault-type door winds shut behind me. It closes a lot more smoothly than it opens. There's a thunk of steel bolts sliding home. Then I notice the background hum of the air conditioners. The interview suites are over there. That corridor leads to 3 cells, that one leads to facilities, staff restrooms, custody officer's room, and a ready room. They're only Cat B secure. We can't store uber-villains here, but it's the best we can do this close to the centre of town. At least until the Crossrail TBMs come available to dig the deep London lock-up they've been talking about. How about a coffee while we discuss your request?
Uh-oh.
A coffee would be great, thanks. I see. And she leads me to the ready room. It does not escape my attention that the entire underground custody suite seems to be embedded in reinforced concrete and has its own air supply.
What is this?
A former nuclear bunker?
Yes, that's exactly what it used to be.
She switches on the battered kettle.
Most of the central London police stations built before 1970 have them. Anyone trying to use them for shelter probably didn't stand a prayer. But they'd still be structurally sound after the rubble stopped bouncing, unlike most of the other buildings. And we'd have needed somewhere for the surviving officers to use as a station. The cells were to be used as dormitories and arms lockers.
Why? Wouldn't you have needed them as, well, cells? Jo shakes her head.
Not after a nuclear war, Mo. Think martial law and firing squads.
She grabs 2 chipped mugs from the cupboard and sloshes coffee and milk into them.
Be glad it never happened.
I fear that we might yet end up going that way if we can't get a handle on Case Nightmare Green. I take my mug and sit down.
Has he coughed yet?
She's a stand-and-pace type.
Alas, yes. Unfortunately, our little canary has gone Section 2 on us. He's absolutely upney.
Footnote. The next stop out from barking on the district line, as in barking mad.
Halfway to Dagenham, in fact. We're keeping him here because he's not deemed a hazard to himself,
But so far, he's confessed to assassinating Margaret Thatcher. But Maggie died of natural causes.
Yes, exactly.
He's also confessed a conspiracy to rob the Bank of England, which is flat-out impossible because he was in custody right here at the time he says he did it. He's delusional about other subjects as well. The duty psychiatrist spent some time assessing him yesterday and thinks he's unfit to stand trial. He's raving about conspiracies and mad scientists trying to take over the world and radio receivers in his head. We did some background legwork and found he was diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic 4 years ago. Looks like he'd been off his meds for some time and was already going downhill fast. He was sectioned twice in the past 9 months, when he came down with an acute attack of superpoweritis. Oh dear. I take a mouthful of coffee. It is, if anything, even worse than the hotel buffet brew. When my eyes uncross, I take another gulp. The last thing I need is a caffeine headache. Well, since I've come this far, I suppose I ought to interview him anyway. You'll be lucky to get anything out of him. Listen, I've talked to more than my fair share of paranoid schizophrenics over the years, and you get a handle on them after a while. Most of them are lovely people. They just can't stop hearing things, and they get mood swings and medication side effects and obsessive-compulsive tics. Spratt's different. His powers mean he expresses his delusions, sometimes violently, on whoever's around him. And something about him doesn't feel right. If I was a shrink, I'd say he's under the influence of something else. But the duty doc took bloods and he's clean. So what you're saying is you don't expect me to get anything out of him? Yes. Also, about that. You know we're going to have to do the rules of evidence tap dance and haul the duty solicitor in if Laughing Boy so much as looks like he wants representation. Oh, hell. I take another mouthful. Well, my cover can't get any more blown than it is already. And I'm not held to the same rules of evidence as... Yes, you are. Joe's expression is fierce. As long as you're in this, Nick, you're on my turf. And we play by the rules here. No spook head games permitted. Jack's going down one way or the other. Maybe he'll pull a long stretch in prison, but more likely, he's due to check in for the Broadmoor rescuer. Where he ends up is for the judge and the psychiatrist to figure out. And if your people really want to take him off my hands, that's another option. But as long as he's in my custody, I am not going to permit you to waltz in and jeopardize his conviction. I raise my hands. I surrender. By messing up his inter... Okay. Sorry, Mo. Didn't mean to blow up at you. I've been butting heads with too damn many cowboys and would-be vigilantes recently. Not to mention the tabloid Angham and Flog'em Brigade and a steady stream of superhero-obsessed liquid bullshit raining down from the top of the pyramid. The Home Office are screaming, and whenever they get a bee in their bonnet, we all get stung sooner or later. She begins to calm down and sips on her coffee. Then pulls a face. This is disgusting. Really? I'd never have guessed. I push my mug away. I just want to run some names past him. What names? Something I found in a box of cereal. Sorry, Joe, I won't know for sure unless he bites. And, national security? Suppose I say I want to rule him out of the Thatcher assassination inquiry that doesn't officially exist? She shakes her head. That's just peachy. Look, I'm pretty sure you won't get anything out of him, but if you insist, I'll set you up. Interview room 2, 10 minutes time. Okay? I nod. Okay. She disappears, and I finish my vile coffee. The third mouthful stuns my taste buds enough to let the rest slip down without too much pain. I hope this isn't going to turn out to be a wild goose chase. 20 minutes later, a placid-looking custody sergeant fetches me from the break room, where I have forced down a second mug of the stuff festering in the bottom of the filter machine jug, and escorts me to interview room 2.
The chief's already in there with your customer, Mom. He's a little excited.